For some time now, I, probably like many other people, have been a fan of cinema. I look at the levels of creativity that the actors, directors, screenwriters, and producers are continually doing and elevating. With this pandemic that we've recently been a part of, or currently a part of, depending on your perspective, cinema was hit hard, the industry specifically. But what we saw is an opportunity to see new cinema that we had either overlooked or avoided. And with the growth of streaming across the world, what you have is more offerings. Offerings like some of my favorites, such as Lupin, Casa de Papel, Soul, Bridgerton, and various Disney series. You look at what happens, and for me, I am creative, or I'm intrigued by creation, and so I decided, you know, I wanted to jump in myself. And so it excited me because I ended up working on screenplays myself. I finished one, I'm working on a book, and I'm working on another thing. Like, creating a world is very powerful, and it's intoxicating, to be honest. So why do I give you all that background? Because in this process, I sought help, and I recognized that I needed more experienced eyes. And so I went where a lot of people went during this time, and I jumped on social media and tried to join or be a part of a group that would help me. And so today I'm going to introduce you all to Kurt Hendricks, and he'll be joining me for a conversation talking about cinema, Hollywood, and just general media, right? Kurt graduated from UCLA, a film and TV production, and he has made short films and music videos. He's been an extra in many things, and he's worked in several areas in Hollywood. He's worked on projects such as Billions, Plot Against America, and Monsterland. His IMDb page is top quality. So today's conversation will be one to share with you one of the personal goals and endeavors that I've been working on, and hopefully it inspires you to create your own world. So let's go. And today on Voices, this episode for me is a personal interest for me because of my love of film and cinema. And I've taken the opportunity in this pandemic, post-pandemic time, so to speak, and I've written books and screenplays, and I joined a couple of communities to reach out to other people who do this and know this, to learn more and to see what they know. And I happened upon, a diamond amongst diamonds, right? I just, the shine on his diamond was illuminated a little more than everyone else. And so today joining me is Kurt Hendricks, and he helped me. He gave me some input and advice about a screenplay I created. And I'm going to give you some more information about him, but in my opinion, no person can introduce themselves better than themselves. So Kurt, welcome to the show, and I'll give you the floor.
Oh, well, thanks. I've been bouncing around the film and television and entertainment business since I was a kid, basically. My mother was in the business when I was born, and you know, I went with her to a lot of shoots. This was regional television. She did commercials and print advertising and just a whole lot of different things. And then I didn't do much until we got to LA and Hollywood, and I went to UCLA and figured out that I did want to give it a shot, and you know, started working around a bunch of different jobs in Hollywood. I was a messenger, I was a production assistant, I was an assistant script supervisor, just on and on. I worked a lot of office jobs that were in the business. And then moved to New York City in 1992 and thought I'd really left the business behind, but I had an employment agent there that kept giving me entertainment jobs in New York City. which I don't know why I hadn't really thought of it that way, but you know, the other half of the whole business is in New York.
That's true.
And that was crazy. I worked in the Brill Building. I worked for Showtime, the cable network, worked for Fox Primetime, and then for a bunch of big ad agencies. And then more recently, I've had time to, I think maybe similar to yourself, go back to doing some writing and some smaller stuff. I shot a whole series of music videos, and we've got two or three more to go. The client for those is releasing a whole album, which every song on the album has a video that goes with it. And that's been fun and a challenge. And I'm writing a book now, about, it's just sort of an everyman's journey. My goal is to have it read like an everyman's journey through the film business, through some of the things I've done, some of the craziest days I've had, and just, but to just put you there, to put you in that moment and not have a lot of hindsight or judgment or anticipation about it, just as if it was happening to you, as if, you know, you got the calls I did, and the reader, yeah, I'm talking about the reader got the calls that I did, and just, you know, roll with it. And that's going well so far.
Well, a question that I'd like to know, especially when, obviously we've known each other since like early last year, so like Marchish. So it's been close to a year that we've originally connected, and you've talked several times, and you've given me quite a bit of good advice. But my first thought was, okay, so you grew up with your family in this industry, and sometimes, children reject what their parents do. So was there ever a time where you were just like, you know what, I'm gonna reject this. I don't want to do this. I want to be an accountant, or I want to be a doctor, or something like that. Was there ever a moment like that?
Yeah, it was, but it was less about rejecting it than thinking, is this really what I want to do? Because the business, especially when I was coming up, so 1980s, and the business was not good. Hollywood was one of the diciest places I've ever lived. And I've been in New York City and various places, but Hollywood itself, like within the city limits of, or the area of Hollywood, was just a really dangerous place to be, because
Really?
there's a lot of mentally ill people on the street. It draws people like a magnet, and the business wasn't that good. The VHS tapes were, VHS came out really strong around 1979, 80, and so the porn industry was just exploding in the early 80s. And that was all based in the same, it was all sort of one big continuum of the business. And yeah, I wasn't sure that I'm like, this is really what I want to do. Plus, it's long hours. It's like you're working 14-hour days. You're just there until it's done. And it's the same thing over and over. And there's a downside to it. So I was looking at, well, there's two options. One is find a job within this film television business that you do want to do and that you could do for 10 years, that you wouldn't burn out on in like 18 months or something. And then the other one was like, well, yeah, walk away from this thing and go have a regular income. Go make some money. And plan B was mostly around the computer game industry,
Really?
which is it's tan you know it's a tangent of the thing. At the time, before computers were any good, some of the first computer games were called Text Adventure, and so you're just reading stuff and you're reading a story, and it would come down to an option and say, well, do you want to go east, west, south, north, right? And then you'd make a choice, and you'd come back to confront the Black Knight or the monster or whatever, and it'd go around like that. But it wasn't graphics; it was all text. And then from there, it grew out to a lot of first-person shooter games, like a really primitive version of Doom. And if I would have stayed with that side about it, I'd be retired and crazy wealthy and stuff right now.
You would be, because that's literally life right now. I mean, that's what they do. And then, obviously the gaming industry has like micro transactions to help you continue in your story or improve. So yeah, not only that, you might have been super duper rich off of
Oh, it's cr
that.
yeah, it is crazy. There's a lot of great jobs in that business, and there, some of my neighbors are semi-retired now on the royalties from writing songs that go into video games that play in the background of computer games.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's just, and the other thing I wasn't seeing when I was younger is like this is it's all one thing. There isn't a computer gaming business separate from the movie business, separate from television, separate from music. They all sell each other, and that's one of the challenges right now for people. When you have a movie project, the studio is going to want to know, well, can we? Is there a video game involved? You know, can we sell? Is there an app? Is there, how many hooks does this thing have on it? Can we make a theme park ride out of this? Can we, can we make a sequel?
Yeah, because
So
I
that's
mean, I
that.
guess they're trying to cash in as much as they can, right?
Well, that's what you're up against. You're up against Marvel and Superman and Spider-Man and all that, where they do have all those options. I think Disney's releasing, the Jungle Cruise or something this year, finally, and it's just a movie based on the ride at Disneyland, essentially. So
Really?
they've gone backward on that one. But meanwhile, Hogwarts and the whole like Harry Potter thing has become a theme park unto itself. That it's part of like it's a place you can go to now. So
Yeah, I
just
saw that.
another.
And they're making a mini series about that too, aren't they? I think they are.
I think so. Yeah.
One of the things you mentioned, some of the things that you did. Of all the projects you've worked on, what's probably the most memorable? And I reason I say memorable because I seldom classify things as good or bad, right? Memorable can be fall in either category, right? And so I ask, what's maybe the most memorable? Because it leaves a sort of a print on you in some way. So what would you say if you had like maybe one or two?
Well, I got two of them. The most recent one was I worked on an HBO miniseries called The Plot Against America, and that shot in my area about a year and a half ago, and it was the same producer director combo as The Wire, and they were really intense people, and it was just and the subject matter is basically, Charles Lindbergh gets elected. It's alternate history. Charles Lindbergh gets elected president in 1940. And as a result, the United States does not enter World War II on either side. They just let it happen. We don't oppose Hitler and and they carry that forward into the thing. And so the first call I got on this was they said, well, they want you to play one of the bad guys, and you need to go to a fitting. And we'll pay you to go to the fitting. And I did, and I get there, and they said, well, you need to wear 1940s underwear. Like this is, they said, I'm like, what the hell's going on? And they had said, well, these guys are just very thorough. They want this thing totally in period, that nothing violates it at all. So, you got to have cotton boxer shorts, and I'm thinking like, what? And then they put 3 layers of clothing on me, and I'm thinking like, why does my underwear matter? And you can't see the script before you agree to these things. In fact, I never saw the script of the thing I was doing, so I wasn't entirely sure what I was walking into. And then said like, are you okay with smoke on the set, like smoke effects and things burning and whatever? And I said yeah, then I had about went to the fitting, and they take a picture of you in the whole get up, and then about 4 weeks goes by, and you get the call to go out to this place. And they said, well, first they told me it was an interior scene and I was gonna have to be there in the morning. And then the day before they said, no, it's an exterior scene and you need to show up around 4 in the afternoon, and we're gonna shoot all night. And I'm like, okay. So I get up there, and it turns out it's the last day of this whole shoot. It's the 55th day. These guys that have been on the crew have been working 55 days straight, like doing 12 and 14 hour days, shooting locations in New Jersey, the Hudson Valley, all over the place. Our shoot was like the third location they had done that day. And the story, it is the scene I'm in is the very last scene in the whole 6 hour miniseries, and they were burning down the me and other bad people are burning down this guy's shop, and they lit this thing on fire about 9 times. It was a They built the facade of this thing out of metal, out of steel, but it looked like It looked like wood. It looked like clapboard, and so they could light it up with these gas jets. And God, it was below freezing. It was it was like 9 p.m. before we started really shooting this scene. And they light that thing up, and then my friend played the shopkeeper, and he's chained to the police car out front while we're burning down his store. And it was just a really intense thing to do, to stay in character and to see what they were doing. It was definitely like the most intense scene that I've ever been in.
And you think the reason they don't, because I've heard about that where they don't they I've heard stories where other actors or people who have been in stories, they don't get the scripts until like they get there. Is it because of the leak culture that exists now where everything gets leaked out?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. They also sometimes they don't want it. Like I had a non-speaking role, so they're just going to tell me what to do, and they're not going to give me the script because I don't need it. But sometimes for principals and for people who do have speaking roles, they don't want them to overthink it or over-prepare. Or there's some directors who work with sort of with a lot more ad lib and spontaneity. So sometimes they'll say, just react as the character would, like put this in your own words. And they don't tell you exactly what to say. And they'll roll. That's a lot more common now that on digital and you're not burning through film. If you do something they don't like, it doesn't cost them anything except time to just do it again. So that's one reason. The other one is what you mentioned, that people, especially like the thing I was on, they made us sign waivers and they wanted to confiscate all the cameras and all that, because if we revealed the last scene of this thing, that's basically a spoiler for the whole 6 hours.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know like there's a Disney series out now, and I know they were talking about leaks because of like tra subtitle translations and stuff. And my thing about that is I'm not bothered by it, so to speak, to hear any of the leak things, because I'm still gonna go see it if it was something I wanted to see. But I do find it disappointing, just the fact that I've written a book and two books and a screenplay, that I would be really disappointed that if someone shared something that I thought was like sort of a good story, and you told the world a story and you didn't let me deliver it in my vision,
Oh
right?
yeah.
I just feel
Yeah.
like that steals away from the whole production.
Yeah. Oh, and I've had God, there was a movie in the 80s called The Crying Game, and everybody said, well, there's this twist in this thing and you'll never guess what it is, and the movie starts and I'm like, well, that guy's a cross dresser, and so that the twist comes up that they reveal that he's a cross dresser, and I'm just like, well, what? I'm still waiting for the twist. I'm going like, so yeah, that guy's a cross dresser, whatever, but where's the twist in this thing? But a better one was like Fight Club. I thought was very well delivered, and it would have ruined that movie to know where it was going.
Yeah, it would have. It would have
Yeah.
completely destroyed the movie if it did that. I agree. That's a good movie.
But it's interesting to those kinds of movies, like to see Fight Club and know the ending. When you see it the second time, you see how well written it was and how they held that back and just sort of like took you down this path where, you might have suspected some, you kind of, you don't know exactly what's going on, but you want to figure it out. You want to know. That's important.
But that's the intrigue, because the thing about it is like I'll watch Fight Club now, even knowing what's gonna happen, because it's just intriguing to look at the writing. And you said you had two, so you talked about the film where you were a bad guy. And what
The
would you
other
say is
memorable one,
sort of,
yeah, that definitely
yeah.
would be my first day in on a job in real Hollywood was I was in film school at UCLA, and but my regular major was English, and so unless you're in the theater arts program, you're not allowed to go to their internship boards, so I couldn't use them to get a job, to get like a foot in the door. And but during the summer, I took a summer class in there, and I forced my way into that room. I'm like, dang it, I spent all this money, let me into the room. And so there's all these cards, and I got a couple of them, and I go to Sunset Gower, which is Columbia, it used to be Columbia Pictures. And they shoot all kinds of stuff there. They shoot, God, they shot everything from Bewitched, The Monkees, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. They shoot Golden Girls. I think they shoot Judge Judy there now. It's just on and on and on. But it's known to be like the cheapest, oldest studio that's still around, those facilities. And I didn't know what I was going to exactly. I went over there. The first thing that I saw on the board was to work in the casting office there. There was an outfit called Henderson and Hanley. So I get there and I want to do the casting thing. And they said, well, can you work days? No. And I'm ready to walk away. I'm like, this is a big waste of time. They're like, no. If you're going to work for free, we're going to find you something on this lot. You know? So I'm like, okay, I don't know if that's good or bad, but okay. And so, so they said, they sent me over to Stage 7, and the guy said, well, you can work nights. I said, yeah. And he said, all right, we're gonna set you up. You're gonna do assistant script supervisor. Here's the call time and come back. And the show was called That's Incredible, which was a TV show that was mostly stunts. It was, this is before YouTube, so people jumping motorcycles and people getting in a box full of snakes and laying down on a bed of nails. And we had a guy that smoked 140 cigarettes at the same time. Like he
Wow.
could he lays down a metal ring on the table and he stuffs what is that, 7 packs of cigarettes in there, and then he has to take his fingers around his mouth to get them all in there like a snake or something. And then they lit him up, like two different people from the show had to light all those cigarettes at the same time with like a Bic butane cranked all the way up, without setting the guy's hair on fire. It was just a wild bit. And but the guy told me, so like, well, you're gonna work assistant script supervisor, but we need you to do whatever. It's like, are you cool to do whatever we ask you to do? And I said yes, even though whatever they ask you to do, because you can be quiet.
Yeah, I believe
That
that.
includes
Yeah,
some
I
things that
believe
I
that.
probably don't want to talk. Well, I'll say no at the time. I'm not going to say no now. Let's just say yes. And I get there and I did a little bit of script supervisor, and then they're like, well, we need somebody to hold boards for somebody who's going to do karate on the show. When first they came by and they just go like, well, how tall are you? It's a 6'2". And they go, oh, that could work. And I've got no idea. I'm like the script supervisor. Why'd they ask me how tall I am? And so they send me off to get a costume and to come back, and it just rushed the whole time. And it's like you're on stage, and before you even know it, and it was the karate grandma. So this woman is like in her, she's over 65. She's been doing 65 and 70, and she's not especially big. She's kind of frail looking, and they positioned me and another guy to hold boards, and I don't do karate. So I mean, the last second, they're showing, well, keep your fingers in this position, or they could get broken and that kind of stuff. And she throws the first
Wow.
kick on camera. She throws the first kick, and it goes right into my fingers. And
Oh.
I'm thinking, maybe it hurts so bad, I just don't, maybe the pain just hasn't cut through yet. And then I'm like, a half second later, I'm like, no, she's got no strength in that kick, And we're going to be here all night. She kicked the board about 9 times before it even cracked.
Wow.
But that whole day was they shoot 3 episodes back to back, so we work 12 hours the first day and then 12 hours the next one. And there's a bunch of other, it just went on and on and on like that. We had a bodybuilder that was going to break the record for a triple lift. He had to do 3 different lifts, and his manager would slap him in the face before he's ready to do the lift. Like, his manager would get up and he's like, are you ready to do this, Boris? And he's like, yes. And then he just slapped him. And and I'm on headset, and the director's in the headset where they can't really hear me. He's like, slap him once for me. Because the guy, he would attempt the lift, and then like, okay, we need 20 minutes for him to sort of get his blood back into condition to try this thing again. And the director quickly does the math, and he's just like, we're going to be here for like 2 or 3 hours basically to get these lifts on tape.
Wow, it's fun. What's funny to me is the types of things that get approved to become, to sort of public media. Now, you said you were an assistant script
Yeah.
supervisor. Well, what exactly is
Well,
that?
on a this on on a TV show like that, a script supervisor would be traditionally, like in a movie, they would be on the shoot and they would keep track of any changes that are made to the script. And sometimes they do continuity as well. It just depends on how big the crew is. If the crew's really big, there's a separate person to do continuity. If there isn't, then the script supervisor does it. On this one, we were keeping track of changes in the script because Guinness Book of World Records was there and they wouldn't certify certain stuff. So this guy shows up to do like one-arm push-ups and Guinness is watching him. They're like, you know, that's not the style, it's not the right style, and they can't do them the right way. So we had to change the script where it said, you know, he will break the Guinness World Record for the number of one-arm push-ups down to he will break a personal record for his own style of one-arm push-ups. And you know, it was stuff like that throughout the shoot.
Oh, that's interesting. And so it just shows sort of the challenges that happen when you when something is planned and then when it actually has to go into production. And that leads me to a question that I think is kind of vital. I mean, I don't know how many people are interested in being Hollywood, right?
Yeah.
But what would you say are some of the hidden challenges in the industry and some of the areas maybe to improve? I know they kind of are one and the same.
Yeah.
So what are some of the hidden challenges and stuff you think could change or be
Well,
improved?
a hidden one I'd say that people don't expect sort of going in maybe is the 12 to 16 hour work day. Like I didn't expect that, and I'd been around the business quite a bit, but it depends on what you're shooting. If you're working on a soap opera or something, then they probably have a 6 hour day. But if you're working on anything that as the budget goes down, the hours go up. And on a feature or something, you're just there until they get it done. That the Plot Against America thing, we wrapped that thing at 4 o'clock in the morning. You know. And
Wow.
so that's so I don't think people always and it takes and especially if you're gonna work 55 days like that back to back. That's a lifestyle. That's not just a job. That affects everything else that you can get done. And you know, people on a crew like that are resorting to performance enhancing drugs and stuff to do it. You know, and then that's just not that's that was one of the drawbacks for me. Like I just thought I just don't want to live that way, especially. It's exciting and stuff for like the first month, but after that, if it's really going to take a toll on your health and all that, like what's the point? And what could they improve? I'm not sure. Right now, there's a lot more opportunities for people because just like what the stages were all booked because of the streaming, because of Netflix and Quibi and Hulu and all these other ones, they're all trying to produce their own content. So there's more stuff in production right now than there's ever been. So there's a lot of opportunities for people. They could improve maybe the pathways in so that people can come in so that they have access to the best talent and people are well prepared when they get there. It would serve both sides of the equation. We would serve the employer and your potential employee just to know sort of like here's a path in this thing. Here's where you start, and if you do this well, then you can go on to these other types of positions.
That's really interesting. You know, one thing that I did want to kind of notice, I did a podcast with a guy who was in a professional esports team, and he mentioned PEDs as well. And so I think there's a lot of drugs out there that, you know, I mean, obviously people assume drugs were in Hollywood, but I mean PEDs just, you know, just to keep going through it is a pretty significant thing that maybe I'm naive, but I wouldn't have expected to hear about that as far as like the people working to continue to go. Like you think more along the lines of the actors or the actresses, but wow, that's an intriguing thing to hear about that.
Yeah, no, it's been like that since, you know, the Judy Garland days and stuff. They talked about that's how she got hooked on the combo that she'd do uppers during the day and then she couldn't sleep, so she'd go to the downers and the whole bit. But you know, she's only on set for 6 hours. The crew's there for 14, so.
And that's interesting because the thing is, like I mentioned again, how we even know each other is that, I wrote a screenplay, and when I wrote my screenplay, and I actually have two more that I have in my head and a short I'm working on for myself. I planned on producing everything myself in my own way, right? Sort of some in a rudimentary sort of a basic way. But you mentioned something about people who are looking to get in the industry and start. They should know some of these things, especially since there's more production houses. So, what would you tell an aspiring creative looking to get their feet wet and maybe film as a writer, an actor, to producer, or just or working on the set? Like, what would you tell them?
The easiest way to get on a set and get paid and figure out, what your next moves will be is to sign up with one of the agencies that does casting for extras for background work. That's why I got four jobs in a year, and I wasn't really trying hard to do it. Because they always need, there's a bunch of things there. You don't have to be an actor. You don't have to be good looking. You don't have to be anything except show up on time and be sober and be ready to work 14 hours. And and there's an opportunity there. But they're always looking for people who have not worked before. That if your face was prominent in something else, if there's if you've done a commercial or something that's running on TV, they don't want you on a show that's going to be right next to that. Even if you're just sitting in a restaurant behind the main talent or something, it's distracting. So the good news there is that if you've never done it before, they'll be that much more willing sort of to take you on for a couple of bits. And if you have a sort of a type look to you, but you're gonna go and you're gonna sit around for quite a bit of the day. They might cut your hair. Like I've compared it to be like a show dog, that they just like they'll handle you as if you're an animal. They'll just turn your chin with their hand and look at you, and different people will talk about you as if you're not even in the room. It's bizarre. It's a bizarre experience, but the good side is definitely like you're gonna be there all day with other people who are excited about the film industry. I've had all kinds of great conversations about, you get into debates about what's a great film and what isn't, and did you see this, and where's the last place you worked, and there's a lot of time for that, and it's interspersed with these moments of like, okay, everybody get out in the street, we're shooting the parade scene, and you go do that for 20 minutes, and then it's a break while they reset, and you go back in. Anybody who lives near New York City, Los Angeles, Atlanta, Georgia, or New Orleans can go to centralcasting.com. And even if you don't live near one of those, if you wanted to sort of look at what this is about, go to centralcasting.com and look at the listings there and what they're asking for. It's also good for writers and for people who are trying to get into the business and sell stuff. If it's almost like the stock market, you can see what's being cast right now. What are people actually? There's a project that's been funded. They're spending the money. They're casting. They're shooting right now. It'll be on TV in 6 months or 9 months from now. So it gives you a look at the future of what's coming down the pipe. It's a great place to start, and also to get on and meet people. And if you're a writer, if you're a screenwriter, part of the challenge is it's a really lonely thing. That if you're sitting around just thinking, well, here's this screenplay, and I think it's good, or I'm trying to make it good, and you're not getting a lot of feedback, and Hollywood seems 1,000 miles away and all that. If you go do an extra job, you've been on the set, you've seen how that screenplay gets interpreted into actual product, and you have a chance, if you're not a total pain in the behind, to go talk to people that are the writers that are on the show and ask them some questions about, like, well, is there any opportunity, or what would you do if you were me? Stuff like that.
That's awesome. I mean, I've seen I've seen different places where they have extras, and it's always been an interesting thing. I've never pursued it, but I thought it's always been interesting. You kind of made mention about something that I think it should be addressed as well, is like, what are some of those other jobs in the industry that are vital
to the production of these things, but are often overlooked. What do you think of some of the jobs that are overlooked but are super vital?
So this is behind the camera stuff, would be, that's an interesting question. Like, none of it's really vital when you come right down to it. We're making, these are people's, dreams and fantasies going up on a screen for other people to be entertained by. So, the world wouldn't end if that stuff stopped. But, I'd say sort of the undersung heroes are people that do good casting, because there's directors who claim that your movie is basically 80% of it's casting. Whether the thing's ultimately going to work or not happens in casting. You cast the wrong people, you're just going to waste time and money trying to make it work. So that's a big one. Another one might be, I mean, the stuff that people just don't see would be insurance. You cannot start a production without what's called a completion bond, which means that it's insurance against the production not making a product. If you don't make it all the way to finishing the film, you basically wasted whatever amount of millions of dollars that you spent in making an incomplete film.
Wow,
So
well, that's, yeah.
they make you put up a bond up front, that says that, your loans will get paid and some of this other stuff if you don't, if the lead actor dies, if the you don't know if anything comes up that you just can't finish the film.
That is interesting. It's funny that, insurance is probably one of the, I'm picking my words carefully, but that one of the most bulletproof industries out there. I mean, they're everywhere. Like that, history showed us the only industry that really wasn't banged during the Great Depression was insurance. So it's quite interesting that the world can be in a downturn, but insurance is like, that's you.
If life is a casino, then those guys are the ones that are running the casino,
And
basically. There's no way for them to lose. They just put odds on everything.
house money.
Yeah.
And so
Yeah.
you mentioned a couple of things, so I want to make sure that we highlight the things that you have going on. So you mentioned a book, and so and it's kind of like alluding to the last things that you said about helping aspiring individuals. And so did you have a release date for your book and a specific title for it?
Well, I have a target. I don't. I've got a title that I love, so I don't really want to let it out yet. But
That's fine.
it's a. I've got about 30,000 words. I want to get to 90,000 on this thing, and it's really. It's going to be about 30 individual days, just spread out over the course of 30 years of just wild days, just sort of like. And they'll all be standalone. They'll all be like, here, I got a phone call. They said, can you be Vice Admiral Lord Mountbatten in this miniseries? I'm like, heck yeah. So you go to the fitting, and then they put you in on loan from the royal family in England, and this dude who's the consultant on the show has to look at you, and he's holding his chin thoughtfully, and he looks at me, and he's like, and he turns to the director, and he's like, well, this is your Mountbatten. And I can't tell yet whether I'm good or bad. And he's like, and he nods just gently. He's like, okay, pretty good. It's just weird stuff like that. It's just stuff that it's the detail that's behind it. It's sort of the reality of the business rather than the glamour and the celebrity type stuff. And I think there's an audience for that. I think, either people that have worked in the business or that want to work in the business, I think can relate to it.
Well, the top 1% are the ones that get noticed anyways. We miss the people that do that are in so many things that we don't really know who they are. So yeah, I think that's important. And these other
Yeah.
productions really, really matter. And speaking of other productions, because I know you yourself have sort of your own project outside of like the book project, you have a documentary that you're working on. So did you want to give some information on that, or just kind
Sure.
of
Oh,
like
sure. Yeah.
lead in on that? Yeah.
That's one that I was looking at. I've been frustrated that I getting on in years, and I'm probably not going to be able to make a feature, which was sort of on a bucket list. And I thought, well, a documentary is at least doable. You go shoot interviews. You don't need actors. You don't need sets and all these, you know, those kinds of expenses. Go shoot interviews and enough stock footage and enough B-roll and stuff, but tell a compelling story. And, you know, that can be done. That seemed very doable. So I was living in the city of Hudson, New York, and heard a lot about Henry Hudson, the person. And that took me down this path. I mean, some of the first stuff was, well, one of the first things I heard that got me into it was they said, well, nobody really knows who this guy's parents were or the year he was born or what he looked like. That picture you always see of him with the little ruffly collar on is a total made up thing that nobody knows what this guy looked like. And it shouldn't matter. That's the other part. It was like, why does it matter what he looked like? But it took me down to, okay, so how come so much stuff is named after him? If this guy, nobody, you know, he didn't discover it. That was the other part. He didn't really discover anything. Jamestown, Virginia was already in place. Boston was already there. And the guy sails into the middle of this thing. He sails up next to New York City, basically. So to put it more specifically, he didn't discover anything, but he mapped certain things. And then the Dutch, I think the reason that Henry Hudson ultimately rises to the top is that he becomes the center of this battle between the Dutch and the English over who really had the right to claim the stuff that he saw. One of the other rumors that got me into it was they said, well, he was, the theory was that there's no record of him outside of the voyages. It's not just, there's no birth record. There's no baptism. There's no schooling. We don't know who his parents are. We don't know what he did before 1607. We don't know what he did after 1611. He doesn't exist outside of these records. And I'm thinking, well, maybe this guy is such a scoundrel that they just covered the rest of it up. Maybe once, yeah. Because they do that. Once they've decided this guy's going to be a national hero, they just bury everything that they don't want people to know. So I thought that's possible, and that'd be a great document, because I don't care if I poop on the British history. But getting into the research, those answers aren't knowable. There's nobody's going to be able to uncover that stuff. Even it gets weird. Like, so the most famous mission is the 1609 voyage up the Hudson River. And a surviving journal on that one was kept by the first mate named Jewett. And it never mentions Henry Hudson by name in the whole journal. It just refers to him as the master. And I'm thinking, well, again, like, so is this guy made up? Is this like, is this sort of like a secret agent? Is he like a double agent, or is he like Oliver North or something, that he's snooping around in North America and he's claiming land and he winds up going into the, he sails on the next mission. They sail around the French up into the Hudson Bay. And they're looking for minerals. They're looking for a place to put a port up there, even though France has already claimed all of that stuff. Champlain hears about it, and he goes looking for him. It's great. There's so many great stories that happen in those 4 years that I'm having trouble sort of narrowing the whole thing down into some sort of nugget and sort of a story that can be told in a satisfying way in 90 minutes. And the other part of it is that people like an ending. They like to know, okay, well, give us the answer. Once you create the question in their mind, they want the answer. If you can't deliver the answer 90 minutes later, I think they're going to feel ripped off.
Yeah. So, well, he's kind of like the Wizard of Oz.
That's true. Well, that's right. They gave him a nice alarm clock or something at the end there.
And that's interesting. So a couple of questions for sort of full scope. So again, I met you through a social media platform for screenwriters and things like that. So what was your motivation to be in a group like that? Like, with the fact that you're already in the world?
I like that group because, It's like solving a puzzle. Like, people would put up their log line, their idea for a screenplay. And I just took it as a challenge to sort of say, well, you know, how could you improve that? Like, what would be better? If that's wrong, what's right? What's better than that? And I, you know, a lot of times when you give advice away to people, you feel compelled to do it yourself. And so it's motivating that way. Otherwise, you're just full of crap. You know, if you're going to tell other people stuff you wouldn't do, then what good are you? Somebody said, you know, advice is what worth what you pay for it. Nothing. You know, if it's such a great idea, why doesn't that person do it? So I don't want to live in that world. But the more I did it, and I also was using that kind of feedback and that kind of interaction to feed a project that I'm still that got stalled by COVID. Which is I'm going to shoot a mock trailer. So it's a the idea is it's 2 minutes. It's a 2 minute trailer for a movie that doesn't exist yet. But it looks exactly like the movie does exist. And so you can take that trailer and you can show it to people and say, well, if this was a real movie, would you go see it? You know, you can do the same thing with producers and say, hey, can you sell this thing? And it's a lot easier if you've got that mock trailer. It does a bunch of great things. One is producers won't read a script because it's 90 pages and they're just not going to do it. But if it's 2 minutes and they can watch it on their phone, you've got a shot, you know, and they'll look at it and they'll say, well, ooh, they'll be like, well, there's a bunch of stuff in here I would change. But if they like the basic idea, you know, you're in, you've got a deal. So that's a great part of it. And I'm not sure that I'm cut out to write a miniseries because I like a story that ends in 100 minutes. I don't want stuff that it's frustrating when you know that, hey, I'm watching 2 hours worth of this thing tonight, but I'm not going to get the end of this thing unless I sit here for, you know, next week for another 2 hours and after that and after that and after that. I haven't been great at that, but I think the idea that I've got for this thing is good and is sellable. And also I found out that a guy that I used to work for is now the head of Lionsgate Studios. And they're building a brand new studio like 60 miles south of me. They're building a studio between me and New York City. And he's the CEO of that studio now. So he's going to be the first stop on this thing. And I can send it to him and say, you know, if this isn't right for you, who can you just turn me on to somebody else that's a better fit for this project?
That's cool. And you know, you kind of you covered 2 points that I actually have been thinking about. The first one is that your point about you, like many other people, in my opinion, need finality in when they watch something in that 90-minute window. And if you don't get sort of closure in that, then they start to question, you know, the whole thing. And I know like Disney has a TV series right now that a lot of people are like, oh, this show is so bad because they didn't get the answers they wanted after, you know, the first episode. And just kind of seeing how Disney did with their other things associated with this series, I felt like people kind of went in and pretended to be uninformed in how they function. So I get it. There are a lot of people want that closure. But I was going to ask you about log lines, right? And so your idea of a mock trailer, I find that to be intriguing because you mentioned reading log lines. I know in my personal experience, log lines can be a little bit of a challenge. Like you can have an idea, but to write a log line,
right,
it's not, I'm not going to say it's hard because anything can be done, but it's a challenge to write a log line. So how important is that, do you think?
Well, there's, you know, two things on that one. One is that I think in Hollywood, probably in film and television, you're writing as part of a team. Like especially if it's a television show, you might be part of a group of 4 to 10 writers on a TV program. If it's a comedy, it'll be even more. It might be 12, 14 people. On a feature film, there's definitely going to be somebody that goes over the thing, that does a polish, the script will get passed around. You know, there's all kinds of things that happen. So it's good to start with a really strong structure and also to just be open to the idea that, you know, if you're going to sell this thing, whoever buys it, it kind of owns this story, and they're going to do something different with it.
Yeah, I think that's something that people they have a vision, and then if they have the opportunity to quote unquote make money off of that vision by selling it to someone who can produce it, I think sometimes they do miss the potential and reality that it will be altered to make it in a sense profitable for the buyer, right? And so
Well,
I think people.
it's their money. I think there's an idea that, especially outside of writing, outside of screenplays, I've told people about, I sell electronics, and people say, "Well, do you have a patent on that?" And that's their first thought. And I'm like, "No, because a patent's not going to stop anybody, just like a copyright's not going to stop somebody bigger than you from taking that idea. If you're Aaron Brockovich and you write the story of your life of how you stood up to a nuclear power plant, then you're in that deal. They can't make that story without you because it's your story. But for most of us, we can be cut out of the thing and immediately. They like the idea, fine, but you're not a writer, and they know a writer, and they'll give it to the writer. Major films and major people get lifted and made into other projects all the time. The whole movie Home Alone was based on a French movie that came out a year before that thing. And those guys sued them, and they didn't get anything. And
Yeah,
it's the movies, I will say the movie is substantially different. It's much better than the French one, but there's no doubt that that's where the idea came from. So I'd encourage anybody who, if you have an idea, two things. Don't be so afraid of like people stealing the thing, because you can always, if somebody steals it pretty much outright, you can get what they call go away money. So they'll never admit that they stole it, but they'll pay you a certain amount to just go away. And that's not the worst thing in the world. I think there's also a conception with beginning screenwriters that you write the screenplay and you've worked really hard on it and you love it, and you think that's what's going to sell. But ultimately, there's two paths for screenwriting. One is to write the stuff that you love and just do it for the pleasure. Just do it as a challenge because you feel compelled to do it, because you feel rewarded by getting that story down on paper in a way. And the other one is, if you're going to focus on actually getting paid and making a career out of the thing, then the goal really on those screenplays is to get work for hire, to get hired. Somebody looks at your script and they said, "Well, that's good. And it's a lot like this idea that I have. So I want you to write from scratch this whole thing that I'm going to tell you." And it's like there's two female leads and a male lead, and they're in Tahiti, and they'll give you the whole thing, and then you have to go write that. But the good news is they'll pay you.
Well, getting paid to do something that you like, it sounds intriguing, right? So the podcast is called Voices of My Brothers, Sisters, and People. And I do this podcast because I want to make sure that people are connected to the things that I feel have enhanced my life as well. And I also like to laud the people that I feel like have enhanced my life. And so I leave the final word of the podcast to the contributor of the show, because I think that the show, the essence of it is about what they had to say. And so the final word of the podcast is always on something that the contributor wants it to be. So it can be about what we talked about or about something you want. But with that being said, I thank you for being here, and I will leave the final word
Oh,
with
my
you.
pleasure. I've enjoyed communicating with you online and finally, having a voice-to-voice conversation. I'd say for my final point would be just that art and writing in general are the place where we do find where the world can come into order. It's like a response. Some of the best writers and some of the best artists have very chaotic lives. They have so many loose ends and so much, injustice and chaos in their life that art is the place where they can find order. It's almost like the counterbalance. So it comes out in art. The art is the place, and whatever that is for you, if it's music, if it's writing, dance, photography, whatever that is, it's about finding order and finding something satisfying in a world that can often lack that satisfaction. And I think it's rewarding for anybody, whether your script sells or not. write it because you want to write it, because you can find something on that page that you know, it gets it out of you. And that's always a healthy thing.